Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, September 24, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on developments at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. My name is Katie McClendon, and I'm the Director of Publications at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our experts, Wayne Abernathy and Jerry Lozier. Speaker biographies were provided to you in the notice of the call, so I'll stop here and preserve more time for their presentations, followed by your questions. With that, I'll hand it over to you, gentlemen.
Terrific. This is Jerry Lozier, and normally Wayne, who's on the line, of course, leads this call. However, he is a little bit under the weather with a cold. Unfortunately, I too have a cold, so this could be the Robitussin Chronicles, with what we could call this, because we both have water and Kleenex with us. But in any event, let me explain that we're part of the Financial Institutions Practice Group at the Federalist Society. Wayne is the chairman of that group, and Wayne has asked me to head up the CFPB working group, subgroup of the practice group. And every month when the practice group meets, we discuss developments at the CFPB. So this teleforum is actually a little more broadening of the report that we give every month. In this case, there's about 14 developments that I think Wayne and I have discussed that we think are worth touching on out of maybe 25 or 26 that we have listed in a written report that the Federalist Society has on its website. Let me start with one development that I think is worth talking about, and the background on the development I'm going to talk about is that, to remind everyone who's a listener, the Dodd-Frank Act authorizes the CFPB to limit the use of pre-dispute arbitration clauses in consumer financial contracts after it conducts a study of such clauses. The CFPB did conduct a study and released the results earlier this year. The development I'm reporting on now is that the Mercatus Center at George Mason University published a working paper criticizing that arbitration study. The George Mason paper is authored by the Federalist Society's own Todd Zywicki, who's a professor at George Mason Law School, and also co-authored by Jason Scott Johnston, a law professor at University of Virginia. The paper concludes that the CFPB's own study shows that arbitration is relatively fair and relatively successful at resolving a large range of disputes. And the Mercatus study cites what it considers poor methodology used by the CFPB, and it gives the example that the CFPB did not have access, of course, to information about the terms of arbitration settlements, but the CFPB did have access to information on the terms of class action settlements, and so the CFPB had nothing to compare the class action settlements with because it did not have access to the arbitration settlements. And in addition, the class action settlements that the CFPB cites the benefits of all related to fewer than a dozen large class actions, most of which involved debt collection cases in which normally arbitration is not an option. So it's interesting. It's worth noting, I think, that there's beside the wide range of criticism of the CFPB's arbitration study, there's this new paper that just came out, co-authored by Todd Zywicki. Wayne, how about the IG's report?
Thank you very much, Todd, and I appreciate all of you who are on the call today. I'm going to talk about several reports, one the IG report, another item dealing with an issue called Symphony, and a third item with regard to enforcement actions at on deposit discrepancies. First item, the Inspector General for the Federal Reserve Board is also the Inspector General for the Consumer Bureau. That's because the Consumer Bureau is a bureau of the Federal Reserve, and that was done for both independence reasons and also as a means of funding the Bureau. The Bureau is funded by basically submitting a bill to the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve can neither say no nor question the bill presented to them. They just are required to pay the bill at the Bureau. But what comes along with that is that the Bureau is subject to the Inspector General of the Federal Reserve. And on August 7th, the Fed's Inspector General released its work plan, highlighting 12 ongoing projects that they're looking at with regard to the Bureau and several projects that they have going forward. And some of the projects, or several projects they have planned, several of the projects that they're currently working on include an audit of the Bureau's distribution of funds from its civil penalty fund. Under the Dodd-Frank Act, the Bureau is allowed to collect penalties from firms, from offenders that it believes have broken the law or committed violations. And it can take those funds, and then it has a responsibility to use those funds to try to address some of the injuries that people had incurred from the actions of the firms that were the focus of the enforcement action. What the Bureau has been finding out is that it's easier to find injury than it is to find the people who are injured, and that's why the Inspector General is looking to see how they're actually dispersing those funds. Are they actually getting to injured parties? And if so, what is the methodology that the Bureau is using, and is it a sound one? Second item on the list from the Inspector General is an audit of the Bureau's public consumer complaint database. This is something that the Bureau has been trumpeting really in very intensively for the last several years and have been building upon. The most recent increase added item to that database is to allow consumers to provide unedited and unaudited narratives of why they believe this or that financial institution has been doing bad things. And the Bureau publishes those on its website. And the Inspector General is going to audit that process and look at a number of issues and concerns that have been raised about questions of fairness, questions of accuracy, and so forth, and how those are managed. Another item on the Inspector General's current activities list includes an audit of 2015 information security programs for the Bureau to see how effective their programs are at preserving the security of the information that they gather. The Bureau gathers enormous amounts of data from financial institutions under its supervision, and the audit is to take a look at how secure that information is. One other item that I'd point to in their current ongoing set of 12 is an evaluation of the Bureau's coordination with external organizations to implement its targeted consumer education. Again, the Bureau is allowed to use its funds, its own funds, as well as funds that it collects from financial institutions that it supervises, and particularly ones that have been the focus of enforcement actions, and use those funds to promote consumer education, working with outside organizations. I believe the concern here that the IG is looking at is to what extent or how is it that the Bureau is selecting those parties with whom it provides the funds and partners in the consumer education. There have been a number of allegations raised that the program that the Bureau has is vulnerable to being a system of payoffs to cronies and political allies. We believe that's something that the Inspector General will be looking at. With regard to the planned projects that the Inspector General has announced that they want to step into, but have not yet begun. One is an audit of the Bureau's contract solicitation, selection, and award process. That's besides the education program. There are a number of other ways that the Bureau engages with outside parties, offering contracts and other support that they draw upon from outside parties. Again, I think the concern is whether what the criteria are for selection and for seeking outside parties to participate with them, and again, whether it whether indeed the criticisms that have been raised that there's a vulnerability of for payoffs to cronies and political allies is actually well-founded. And then another one that I mentioned is the audit of the Bureau's privacy data and Personally Identifiable Information Program. The Bureau claims that in gathering its vast amounts of information, which includes information on credit card actions and other private financial transactions of millions of customers, to what extent is the Bureau being very careful to be sure that personally identifiable information is protected from being released into the public or to hackers or others who might abuse that information? And I'll mention, as we go through these various items, please make notes if you want to follow up with us with any questions or comments or thoughts you have. There will be a question and answer time when we are concluded, and we'll be happy to expand upon any of these. We're just giving you a brief outline to set a number of things on the table. Next item that I'd like to turn attention to is a letter from in August from Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts to Director Cordray. She was very concerned about a project that a number of financial institutions have entered into to create a means of sharing of information and communication among financial institutions, basically to compete with the Bloomberg network that financial institutions have long had for a number of years to communicate with one another on financial issues and business matters. And they wanted to create a competitor to that because there was some concern that they needed to have some competition in this area. And a company was set up called Symphony Communications, which 14 large financial institutions and other financial firms helped finance. The concern was whether or not regulators, the Bureau and others, would have access to those communications and the information that is provided through that system. One of the arguments that is made to encourage participation in the system is that there's not an intention to store data. It's just supposed to be a means of communication, much like a telephone call would be, that once a telephone call is done, it's done. Nobody's been storing the information of the call, yet these would be done electronically, much like email communications. The concern of Senator Warren and some others who are worried about it is that there wouldn't be a paper trail, and perhaps in those communications there is the possibility that those communicating might be talking about things that are not wholly in keeping with the law or regulations, and yet if the information shared was not preserved somehow, there'd be no means for regulators to be able to use that information for enforcement purposes. I will note that recently, and by that I mean the last week or two, four large financial institutions in New York City, responding to concerns by New York financial authorities, have agreed that they would retain for a number of years the information that is transferred through this Symphony Communications that could be available in enforcement investigation actions. And then the last item I'll talk about before handing back over to Jerry is with regard to a very interesting enforcement action that took place in the middle of August with Citizens Bank. And this has to deal with a problem that apparently a number of banks have, that when deposits are made by their customers, occasionally the amount of the deposit doesn't match the amount on the deposit slip. Sometimes the customer deposits more, sometimes the customer deposits less. And a number of banks have a policy that when that discrepancy is below a certain threshold, they don't make any corrections to it. The depositor, let's say, deposits $100 and on the deposit slip has listed $90. What does the bank do in that case? Or where the depositor deposits $100 and lists on the deposit slip $110. Again, there's a discrepancy that's found too late to correct at the point of contact. And a number of banks have the policy that when it's below a certain amount, they just go with what was on the deposit slip, the view being that it can be much more expensive to try to make those corrections after the fact than the amounts that involved are, and that they would more or less balance out. The attitude of the Bureau is it should be a zero tolerance, that if there's any discrepancies, the financial institutions should make good on those discrepancies, and particularly where the depositor has deposited more money than indicated on the deposit slip. And the financial institution involved was fined, and with regard to 475,000 accounts over a long period of time, I believe it reaches back to 2008, and the firm agreed to make corrections and to seek out where those differences were and to correct the errors. With that, let me pause and pass it on to you, Jerry.
Thank you, Wayne. Wayne, I just want to mention a couple of things before handing it back to you. One is an amicus brief that the CFPB filed in the Third Circuit in a case involving the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. And the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, among other things, prohibits making a false representation or implication that any communication is from an attorney. And that prohibition in the FDCPA is a weapon that the CFPB is using to say that a debt collector should not be able to file a collection lawsuit unless there is, quote, meaningful, unquote, attorney involvement in the collection suit. And in apparently a lot of these collection suits, the attorney involvement is very, very small. Indeed, in the case at hand in the Third Circuit, it's the facts set forth a given that the attorney spent fewer than 4 seconds reviewing a given collection action. And the CFPB's position is that that's not meaningful attorney involvement, and there has to be meaningful attorney involvement or else there's a violation of this prohibition in the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act against representing or implying that a communication is from an attorney if it's not really from an attorney. And the CFPB's amicus brief is supporting the position taken by the district court in that case. But I think some of us think it's somewhat of a stretch of that prohibition to suddenly say that it's supposed to regulate the conduct, the amount of time that an attorney spends on a piece of collection litigation. The other thing I want to mention, Wayne, is there was an interesting op-ed piece by a Georgetown University law professor, Adam Levitin, recently concerning the CFPB's data collection efforts. By way of background, I think Wayne touched on this, you know, the CFPB collects an enormous amount of information about consumers. And there has been some considerable criticism of the amount of information they collect. And this is the first time someone has written something strongly in the CFPB's defense. The Professor Levitin says that the critics have veered off into, quote, black helicopter paranoia, unquote, and points out that much of the data gathered by the CFPB may be publicly available in mortgage filings, in county land records, or car sales with DMVs, or is otherwise commercially available. Very little of the data is publicly identifiable, and the CFPB anonymizes the data, although lately there's more and more criticism of whether data can ever truly be anonymized, no matter what data fields you strip out of it. Professor Levitin further suggests that the CFPB data is account-level data showing account balances, interest rates, fees, not transaction-level data. So Professor Levitin says that no one needs to worry that the CFPB is learning about their subscriptions, quote, their subscriptions to Ashley Madison, unquote. Anyway, I thought that it was interesting. He also makes the point that persons should want regulators like the CFPB to use evidence to support their rulemakings, and so evidence-based rulemakings are a good thing. And so we should be happy that the CFPB is collecting data to support what they're doing. Wayne, I'll turn it back to you.
Thanks very much, Jerry. Let me turn to now an issue of payday lending. It's no secret, the Bureau has made no secret of its animosity to the payday lending business. Since the Bureau has been in place, it's put in place a number of reviews of the practices of payday lenders, and has, I think it's a frequent element in speeches by Director Cordray, his dismay with payday lenders. But curiously, we saw in mid-August a letter from the Attorney General of the state of Alabama, Luther Strange, sent to the Bureau opposing some of the new regulations that would make it difficult, if not impossible, for payday lenders to continue to offer their products and services to their customers, for which this seems to be a pretty significant market. And the argument they make is that Alabama laws are adequate to make sure that abuses are reined in and appropriately addressed, and that the what the Bureau would do is remove an important source of credit to Alabama customers. And I'd point out that Attorney General Strange's comment really echoes what we've been hearing also from political figures in the state of Florida, who are also concerned that an important source of short-term lending to their customers could be choked off if the Bureau's regulatory language on payday lenders goes forward. On a separate issue, although actually not entirely unrelated, the mid-August story in Automotive News pointed out that the consent agreement with Ally Financial, which is now more than a year old, with regard to the practice of indirect auto lending and compensating the auto dealers who offer loans at the auto dealership, the concern here is that the Bureau believes, and Ally Bank agreed to a settlement case on the basis that by allowing the traditional compensation program for auto dealers, where the lender will offer a percentage rate for an auto loan, and the dealer may mark that up a little bit, and the difference between what the bank offers and what the dealer presents is the compensation that goes to the dealer for making the loan. That's because it's that's what makes it an indirect auto loan. The customer is actually interacting directly with the dealer rather than with the bank, but the bank is the one that's actually making the loan. And the fact that there is some discretion on the part of the auto dealer in setting up that rate, the Bureau believes that women and minorities don't negotiate as well as non-minorities and males do in those situations, and therefore they believe that is a form of discrimination. And that is what they penalized the Bureau for. There was a lot of debate about how the Bureau was able to gather information to prove its case, and some would say they never really did prove their case. They relied upon a proxy for data to establish a case that perhaps minorities and women were being disadvantaged. The problem for the Bureau is that not only is information on ethnicity and gender not collected when a loan is made, the law prohibits lenders from identifying and indicating gender and race and ethnicity in making a loan. So how does the Bureau figure out whether there's been a discrimination going on or not? They use a number of proxies for doing that. The belief is the proxies are certainly, even if you make the case that there's some justification there, they're certainly not precise, and that has turned out to be a very difficult problem in providing recompense to people who are perceived by the Bureau as being injured. In their proxy, they can come up with approximation numbers of how many people are injured, but coming down to identifying the specific people who are injured is a difficult problem for them, and yet the consent agreement provides for nearly $100 million from Ally to be paid to injured parties. What the Bureau has set up now is announcing that if you believe that you have been injured in a loan with Ally in purchasing a car, you have to basically apply to receive the compensation funds, and then an investigation would be made to see whether or not you are an injured party, whether you're a minority or woman purchaser, and so forth. The result of all of that has been, is so far, very, very little of the penalty funds have actually been passed on to injured consumers, and that is a problem that is continuing to play itself out. And the third item I'd mention before handing back over to Jerry is the Bureau has a project that they call Managing Someone Else's Money. In essence, this is a set of guidelines that they are establishing to help caregivers for older citizens in managing the funds of the people for whom they're providing their care, senior citizens mostly. They have published the second phase of what they have is six guidelines. Currently, they're focusing on six states where they believe there are large populations of retired people. The states are Arizona, Florida, Georgia, Illinois, Oregon, and Virginia. These are states that they believe where there are large numbers of retired people and older people living who have other people helping them in the management of their funds. Right now, these are guidelines that they are putting forward by the Bureau. These could be helpful. I think the concern is to what extent are they adequately tailored and to what extent are they harbingers of future regulations. That remains to be seen. Let me pass the phone back on to you, Jerry.
Thank you, Wayne. And I guess I will touch on three more developments. One is, it was interesting, the Clearinghouse, which is an I think I'd call it a trade association. It has clearing responsibilities, but it really represents the large New York money center banks. But it issued a report recently urging the CFPB to regulate the data security practices of startups and tech companies in the same manner that the CFPB regulates the data security practices of banks. And the report cited information security failings of Google Wallet, an app of PayPal, and the practices of social networks like Twitter and Facebook. So it's sometimes unusual to see an industry trade association call for more regulation of someone instead of arguing for less regulation. So that was a development that was just noteworthy for that reason alone. Another development, the Dodd-Frank Act has a provision, Section 1071, that literally requires financial institutions, in the case of applications for credit from women-owned businesses, minority-owned businesses, and other small businesses, the financial institutions are supposed to inquire whether the business is women-owned or minority-owned, and maintain a record of that response, and then submit that information to the CFPB every year and make that information publicly available. Everyone, I think, in the industry acknowledges that Section 1071 is not self-executing and really requires some kind of regulations from the CFPB to really go into effect as a practical matter. And the CFPB has not done that since the enactment of Dodd-Frank in 2010. The development I'm reporting on is that 84 congressmen wrote to the CFPB recently urging it to expedite rulemaking on this data collection on the race and gender of small business owners. And, of course, ultimately this will lead to what is like HMDA data, Home Mortgage Disclosure Act data, where on home mortgage loans, even though generally Regulation B and Equal Credit Opportunity Act prohibits the collection of this kind of information on the race and gender of the borrower, it's mandated under the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, and theoretically it's mandated by Section 1071 in the case of small business credit. Wayne, a last thing I want to mention is the Inspector General from the Federal Reserve did issue a report recently on the hiring practices at the CFPB. People who listen to this report regularly know that there's been a history of employment discrimination allegations at the CFPB. These kinds of reports are very interesting when they come out. This report concluded that the hiring controls that the quote, Office of Human Capital, unquote, that the CFPB has in place, those hiring controls were not always followed. And indeed, 90% of the forms that the CFPB is supposed to be using to document the knowledge, skill, and abilities of people hired to fill vacancies. 90% of those forms did not receive any kind of managerial approval. In fact, 45% of them did not have any approval at all, which suggested that the essential knowledge, skills, and abilities requirements are not being considered by the CFPB when doing its hiring. So that was worthy of note. Wayne, you may have one more item.
I do have one more item, and it's related to something I've talked about already on this call, and this fills out an important point. This is with regard to the consumer complaint database that's published by the Bureau on its website. The Bureau is now several months into a process whereby they allow customers not only to share a complaint that they have in details with it, but also to provide a narrative. In other words, in their own words, explain their concerns or issues that they may have with a financial institution. The problem that the Bureau has come up with is that, as one would expect, when you're dealing with just narratives rather than filling in the blank with the details of particular complaint issues, that you get a wide variety of complaints that are very different from complaint to complaint. And the Bureau thought it would be useful and helpful to readers of their database if they would normalize those complaints. That is, try to find ways to group similar types of complaints together and to create the adequate categories to enhance comparison and their view and increase the ability of people who read the database to look for and find information that they believe is relevant to their particular situations. At the end of August, the American Bankers Association, where I work, sent a letter to the Bureau responding to their request for information as to how the Bureau should go about normalizing their data. And the main point of our letter was that the Bureau has not yet solved the problem about whether the information in the complaints is actually correct. There is no screen as to whether the information is errant, whether it is accurate or inaccurate, or in any way verified. And if you don't solve that problem, then it's hard to normalize the data because you're dealing with data that may indeed be misleading, and grouping misleading information together with factual and verifiable information in itself could be compounding the misleading nature of the data. That was the nature of our suggestion to the Bureau. We'll see what they do about it. Back to you, Jerry.
Thank you. And Wayne, I just have one last thing. I know you touched on the auto settlements. You gave a great explanation of the background on that. There was recently a front-page article in the Wall Street Journal entitled "Bias Fight Lifts Costs of Some Auto Loans," unquote. And the article reported that the CFPB had reached, of course, more than $200 million in settlements in these anti-discrimination claims in the indirect auto finance area over allegations that dealers charge 0.2% to 0.3% higher interest rates to minorities, leading to higher payments of maybe $200 to $300 over the life of a loan. The report indicates that some large automakers are responding by increasing their loan pricing in order to support their dealers, and they mention Honda as increasing its wholesale rate to the highest credit risk, or to the best credit risks, from 2.3% a year to 3.4% a year, and when you add in a 0.5% dealer markup, that would lead to average borrower paying an additional $586 in additional interest payments over the life of a four-year $25,000 loan. So there is a cost to the market of some of these CFPB activities. I think that pretty much wraps up our report, and I think we would be delighted to take questions if there are any at this point.
Great. Thank you for your remarks. I'll now open the floor to your questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a second prompt that will say, "Your microphone has been turned on. You have the floor." We'll be answering questions in the order in which they are received.
You know, Katie, as we're waiting for the first question or comment from our listeners, I want to add something to the Jerry's last point about the Wall Street Journal article on indirect auto lending. And in recent days, the American Banker has also begun a series of articles on indirect auto lending, and again pointing at the methodology by which the Bureau tries to identify whether there has been discrimination. And the recent American Banker article noted that they got a hold of internal Bureau documents where the Bureau admits that their methodology probably overstates the number of parties that are potentially injured by the indirect auto lending process. But nevertheless, the Bureau has gone for it anyway, recognizing that they overstated, their view being better to assess penalties overstating the injury rather than understating the injury. And I think a number of people would take some interest at that kind of an approach to law enforcement in the country. It seems to sort of go backwards from the idea that you're innocent until proven guilty. Here the view is, hey, if we catch you for what you're doing wrong and then find more wrongdoing than actually took place, well, that's better than missing something.
Right. We have one question, so we'll go to that first question. And a reminder to everybody else, to request the floor, you press the star button and then the pound button. So here's our first question.
It's David Emerson, Society member here in Berkeley, California. I want to thank the panelists for their continuing work in this area. It's really good stuff. The question I have has to do with this indirect auto lending case that you mentioned, and it's actually a couple of different parts. I just want to make sure that my understanding is correct and that there was actually no allegation of wrongdoing nor evidence of wrongdoing, and it was simply a failure to aggressively negotiate by the allegedly aggrieved classes that resulted in this disparate treatment. And if that's the case, that's my assumption. Then the second part of it is that if there is a compensation to members of this group, how is the compensation allocated? Is it an individualized analysis of how aggressively or how poorly they failed to negotiate their interest rates, or is it more of just a broad formula?
Jerry, do you want me to take a first shot at that?
I think that would be great.
Okay. Yeah, you've certainly addressed, I think, the key issue here involved with the concept of disparate impact. Disparate impact is different from disparate treatment. The law recognizes very clearly that if you're engaging in disparate treatment, you're making an affirmative effort with the intent to engage in illegal discrimination. The problem with disparate impact is to try to prove that there is discrimination that takes place even when there's no intent to discriminate. And that's the key issue here. And you correctly point out that there's not the allegation that the financial company that is the focus of the enforcement action, in this case, Ally Bank is one of them, had engaged in any intentional effort to discriminate. It's just the view that their policy of the way they compensate auto dealers had an effect that minorities and women would end up with higher interest rates than would non-minorities and men in negotiating. That wasn't the intent of Ally, but that was the result, and therefore that was the nature of their enforcement action. But then that leads to your second question, which is an extremely important one and has been very difficult for the Bureau and others to solve, which is if there has not been a direct intent to discriminate, it's awfully hard to find then who are the actual parties against whom they're discriminated, particularly when in an auto loan, you're not allowed to collect data with regard to race, gender, or ethnicity. Instead, in making their case, they had to engage in a variety of proxies, and that has led to very difficult case for the Bureau to identify who the aggrieved parties who should be compensated. And that's why the compensation fund is virtually untouched. The process that they have set up is and we'll see whether it works, is if you believe you are one of these aggrieved parties, then there's a form that you submit where you make your case, identify your ethnicity and so forth, and provide details. And presumably at the end of that process, applying for compensation, you could then receive compensation. Their concern is that the methodology they use, using surnames, geographical codes, and so forth, could end up providing compensation to parties that were not actually injured or aggrieved. So that remains a very difficult problem that the Bureau has not yet solved, but their approach is to see whether the application process will work. I don't know, Jerry, do you have anything you want to add to that?
You know, the only thing I would add, Wayne, and you may have touched on this earlier, is the problem really is in this, I don't want to call it ridiculous, but this methodology that they use where it's not reliable. It normally in a fair lending case, you see the fair lending cases in the home mortgage lending area where you have actual data collected that is accurate on what is the race and the gender of the borrower. So when there's a settlement, it's very easy to identify, you know, borrowers, you know, because the data is collected on who is a minority and who's not. In these cases, the CFPB uses this kind of Bayesian, I can't remember, geocoding or something, and it's, as Wayne says, it's based on the person's surname and their zip code. And based on that, they make a conclusion that you're a minority, and that's frankly absurd. I mean, that really is not, it's not reliably accurate. It's just absurd. And so as a consequence, they have this problem of, okay, now we have a, whatever it is, $80 million, $100 million settlement out of, from Ally we have to distribute. And then you guess what? You discover that, well, these people were not minorities after all. So we've just shaken down, frankly, Ally Financial for all this money for causing harm to minorities. And it turns out our methodology is such that we can't really prove, you know, we may have been mistaken that there was not as, you know, it's the whole thing. I use the word shakedown, and let me say that's not original from me. I think there's a writer for the Wall Street Journal who wrote an article about this several months ago, and he called it a shakedown, and it's a government shakedown of legitimate business using this methodology that, you know, is not proven. It's not reliable, and it sounds like even the CFPB is acknowledging overstates the amount of the level of discrimination because it overstates the number of minorities. So David, I guess I would say based on your last name and where what depending on what your zip code is, you could be make a claim in the Ally if you bought a General Motors car.
Again, to ask a question, please push the star button and then the pound key on your telephone keyboard. Our next scheduled Teleforum conference call will be tomorrow, that's Friday, September 25th at 1 p.m., and our speaker, Warren Postman, will be discussing class action cases in the Supreme Court term that's coming up. So please do join us for that and consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleforum calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. You can also visit our website to listen to podcasts of previously recorded Teleforum calls you might have missed.
And do we have any other questions from the floor?
If anybody else has any more questions, make sure you press the star button and then the pound button on your keyboard. Well, do either of you have anything else to say while we're waiting? Oh, it looks like we have a couple, actually, if you want me to go ahead.
Yes, please. Let's go ahead to the callers.
All right.
Go ahead, caller. Perhaps the caller has not taken his phone off of mute. I'm not hearing the comment or the question.
Maybe. If you're trying to ask a question, go ahead and try the star and pound key again.
My apologies. My mute button was still pressed.
Understood.
Quick observation or question of what's going to happen in the next month or so with the TRID goings on in the mortgage industry. Y'all really didn't say much about that. Do you have any thoughts of what's happening? Because I'm in the title business, and I am seeing that lenders really aren't prepared for this.
Jerry, you have any? Do you want to lead off on that, or I'm happy to comment on it?
Sure. No, I can start, but I think you probably can give a more in-depth answer, Wayne. But you know, obviously, we have been hearing that, you know, most people are not prepared. You know, as you may know, there have been numerous congressional requests, demands at to the CFPB to please delay the effective date of this until the end of the year. And in my heart of hearts, I think the CFPB, you know, is trying to do the right thing, and they've said, you know, we're not going to aggressively enforce this the TILA RESPA rules, and we're going to, you know, hope everyone can get into compliance. But it really would be so much more helpful if they had just postponed it till January 1. And because clearly you're hearing something like at least 40% of the industry is not going to be prepared in October. So,
but Wayne, yeah, I would add to that, Jerry. We're definitely hearing that from our members, that particularly the ones that rely upon outside vendors to help them put together the information and put the processes in place. And these tend to be smaller banks that don't have the internal skills to be able to create the kinds of forms and other processes that the regulation requires. So they're very dependent upon their outside vendors to do that. And frankly, the outside vendors have not yet completed their process. Once the outside vendor has completed, then the bank has to incorporate it, has to train its staff, has to test it and make sure it works. And the word we hear is that as that deadline very quickly is coming upon us, there is just not a readiness yet. Director Cordray has said that they will look at best efforts and will take a best efforts and good faith defense. But he said it, what I think the industry is looking for is something in writing, because, frankly, if you end up in a court case because you haven't been following the procedures, as you know, the process itself is the penalty, and no institution wants to be in that kind of a situation. So there will certainly at least be some institutions that will have to hold back in making loans where they think there's the possibility that they just might not be able to implement all the details that are required under this new disclosure rule. I will say the Bureau has a curious practice that they have developed so far of when they put forward final regulations, they tend in many cases to give short shrift to operational issues that are brought forward by people who have to live with these rules. And only when faced with the operational reality, the Bureau then has, in several occasions, relented and recognized, well, I guess you guys weren't kidding when you said X or Y was a real problem. And then the Bureau has been willing to provide some assistance, some flexibility, or even made changes in some cases.
Yeah.
But it is an ongoing problem, and it's one that I'm glad you did raise it, and perhaps that should have been high on our list of things that we talked about. Kenya, are there other callers?
If you have a question, remember, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone keyboard. Well, I don't see anybody with a question at this point, so if the two of you have any closing remarks, go ahead.
Wayne, I'll let you go first if you'd like. The only closing remark I would have is that hopefully we will continue these teleforums on the CFPB, because it's a work in progress, and every month there's new developments and there's new interesting things to talk about. So I hope we can continue these.
This is certainly a hyperactive agency, so there will be plenty of material to talk about going forward. And we only touched upon, I think, half of the items on the list that Jerry collects each month. But certainly we would appreciate any other information that people come across or would like to share with us. Please go ahead and do that.
Yeah.
Great. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Wayne Abernathy and Jerry Lozier for joining us today. Thank you also to our audience, and we welcome your feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Please do join us for our next teleforum call, and that's tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.